like to ask for your attention. In fact, I'd like to indulge your attention. I think it's time to identify some of the enemy. French biologist Louis Pasteur said that in science, nature would favor the prepared observer. Yeah. So if you are prepared in your act of observing, you are more likely to pick up on some of the salient details of your observation. I'm sorry, I can't quote them in French. I don't have them off the cuff right now. But I think as a meditator, I could confirm this. The big enemy, really, is not greed and is not hatred, although they're quite... they can be quite intimidating. But really, the major obscuring power lies with ignorance, what Buddhist psychology calls not knowing, which sounds harmless, isn't it? Simple lack of information. Yeah. Just update, download the latest patch, and you're running. It's more tricky than that, I'm afraid to say. Ignorance. Sometimes in Tibetan iconography depicted as the pig, one of our more intelligent mammals. The pig, out of whose mouth, or out of the mouth of which, you have the snake standing for aversion and anger, and the rooster standing for greed because of his keenness on procreation. So the snake and the rooster come out of the pig's mouth, meaning that only under the influence of ignorance we are actually believing that we are successful in our pursuit of happiness on the basis of greed or on the basis of aversion and anger. So only under the influence of that misunderstanding we are likely to engage the other two poisons of mind. And therefore, in the Buddha's take, ignorance was the worst of those three poisons of mind. They're all quite effective in terms of messing up your samadhi or your insights, just to be clear. So let's not fool ourselves. But the most potent form of not understanding lies with the Buddhist notion of ignorance. Now, this may be that indeed we simply lack a crucial piece of information. It may be that we have the information, that we don't add up the information. No? We have lots of information about, I'm sure if I asked you, you would tell me lots about your life, and somehow we know it all in some ways, and yet it doesn't add up, isn't it? Sometimes it's not lack of information or lack of correlated understanding of the information we have. Sometimes it's we don't want to know. You know? We're quite bloody-minded in this. We don't want to actually know. On its most simple level, ignorance, I would say, is energetically a lack of sensitivity. You know? Just not being there. Not quite being there. Not being sensitive, being thick-skinned, being callous, being not available. That's maybe on an energetic level, completely east of moral understanding, the simple lack of present, lack of availability, lack of sensitivity for what's happening. So you have to understand this. I know not knowing avijja moha, delusion. These are all big words, and they, as an explanation, they don't really say much. They say, okay, this is the name of the problem, but they don't tell us how the problem works. Well, that's where it gets interesting. Where is our system affected by ignorance? Our system is affected by ignorance on three major levels. One of them is understanding. Our vision is obscured. Our comprehension of cause and effect, our comprehension of what's happening and what our means are to influence what's happening, that's one layer. Another layer where ignorance works in our system is on our perceptions. Now that's tricky. It means the bit you get on screen, how it looks, what it appears to be to you, that already is infiltrated by ignorance. That's very tricky. You can't get at it reflectively, because as soon as you think about it, you think already with dirty equipment, yeah? Because the equipment you think with is based on perception. And those perceptions are false, yeah? Or falsified. The third level, the ignorance affects the way our heart operates. It troubles the way we understand with the heart. Our notions, it makes us reactive, it distorts the things we see and the things we think because of the state of the heart. In an ideal setup, you would have a clean situation. A clean situation means you have a workbench, you have a workpiece, and you have tools, and you go in there with clean hands and you start working on your workpiece with your set of tools and your clean working environment. But meditation is a messy business. You know, the workbench, the workspace, the tools, and the object you work on is all the mind. You know, so you can't stay squeaky clean. You have to get your hands dirty in this. The very mind that tries to understand itself is also the mind by which you try to understand the mind. The very state you're trying to come to grips with and transform into something wholesome, or try to dissolve, or try to bring to fruition, is the state that affects the way you relate to it. Yeah? So that's what makes meditation so tricky. And the punchline is basically the things that fuel our not understanding, the things that fuel our misapprehension and gradations of not knowing, all this is dramatically influenced by the quality of our awareness, by the capacity of our mind's attention and the continuity of attention. So measured attention generally is in two dimensions. One of them is time. You measure attention in terms of continuity, of your capacity to stay with something. That's one way you could quantify or qualify attention. Another way would be you speak about attention in terms of an area. This can be the area 4 centimeters below your navel. This could be a room full of people. This could be, an airport terminal. And you could establish your attention in that area. Now, rather than staying with one event through time and try to be continually aware of the changes of that, you could just open the space and hold that space. These are two different ways of looking at attention in the Buddhist sense. Remember the images of Satya I gave you yesterday. these images speak of both of these dimensions. The openness, the spaciousness is a very obvious example of the dimension of space. And the kind of probing or the into the wound or the accompaniment of the city's gatekeeper of the two messengers that come from afar to the lord of the said, to the mayor of the city would be examples of a type of sati that is measured in terms of continuity. Yeah? The Buddha has understood that one way we keep ignorant, we keep being and staying ignorant, is by not paying attention properly. That's why he's, rather than browbeating us out of ignorance with the help of, finger wagging, he identified the cultivation of awareness, of attention, of sati as the tool to counteract all forms of ignorance. Not being attentive or being episodically attentive, because we're all in some ways attentive. We all have in some ways attention available, and even mindfulness available. But we are sometimes a bit stingy with this stuff. We're kind of episodically aware and attentive. In fact, I am quite biased in the application of my attention insofar as I favor certain qualities of experience for which I have a lot of time. Yeah. And I have lots of willingness to go into and follow. And other aspects of my life, I have a lot less time for, a lot less attention available. And what makes a distinction is something Buddhist teaching calls vedana, which means basically the degree of pleasure, of satisfaction, of agreeableness I get out of something. This is what predisposes me most favorably for a thing, if it pleases me. If it does not please me, my habituated reaction is I pull away from it. You know? That happens so quick and so often that we think it's almost normal. The frightening thing is, it is normal. You know? A lot more normal than you probably admit. Yeah? So every event in our experience has a component, if you wanted to be petty, we could call it the hedonic aspect of my experience, the pleasure aspect of my pleasure or displeasure aspect. And it is this quality, we strangely don't have a proper word for it in English, we can precisely identify what it is, but somehow English and other European languages seem to refrain from actually wanting to name this. So an unfortunate naming of this is feeling. Buddhist teachers sometimes translate that as feeling, but it is nothing to do with emotion. It is nothing to do with sensation. It is not a feeling. So sometimes I call this feeling tone. This is, I believe, an artificial word, and like all artificial words, it makes us stop a little bit. It has this kind of slightly grating quality. We feel we should know it, but in fact we don't know it. So that's the advantage of artificial words. Vedana's feeling tone basically is pleasurable, it's not pleasurable, or it's neutral. Forget the neutral bits. There are such things, but the truth is, even the subtly pleasurable and the subtly displeasurable, we generally don't get. So for practical purposes, it's the attractive or the pleasurable, agreeable, comfortable, interesting, satisfactory, mildly stimulating, that's the one side, and the opposite side as well. These two basically rule. Yeah? They rule the economy of how sati is being applied. My mind is quite seductible. It likes pleasant things. What things it actually likes, it differs a little bit, you know. Early in the morning, it doesn't like some of the things it likes late at night or so. Yeah. But it consistently likes the things it likes. Yeah, let's put it like that. And that seems to be the case for just about everybody I know. The degrees of intensity and the variation of the things I like, I differ from that. I differ in that from my neighbor, but basically you will identify easily things that you like and dislike. And that there's a kind of a little meter in your mind that says, ding, oh, 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 nice, nice, no, no, no. Yeah. And it does that quite quickly and quite, you know, it's precognitive. You don't need to think about it. It just seems natural. It seems organic. It seems inbuilt. And this little pendulum generally decides how much or how little of my attention a person, a situation, a thing gets. And then my attention, if I just let it go, it likes not the very beginning of something. It likes the beginning a little further up, so about in the first third. Yeah. And then it likes very quickly to go to the top bit, yeah, where a thing reaches its fruition, where it kind of goes into sort of the blossoming mode. Yeah. If you put something in your mouth, you like the blossoming kind of experience when all your mouth is full of a taste. And then you savor that for a moment, and then when it has reached its peak, you quickly wonder what the next one will taste like. Instead of staying with this one till it kind of stops, you want one of those over there. Yeah. So your attention hops from the one you still have. You could still get quite a bit out of if you wanted. But in fact, you're already a little bored with it because there is the promise of something else. So your attention hops. It tries to basically surf from one tip of the wave, from one crown of the wave to the next crown. Yeah. If I let my habits have reign, then they would like to just skim the surfaces of things. The nice bit, that top part where I get the full hit. Yeah? I don't want to bury that process. I don't want to have it disappear and go down and gradually taper. And I'm not so interested. Only if it's painful, then I like that bit. Yeah. If it's painful, I like the stopping, I like the subsiding, I like the ending of things. If it's pleasant, I like the beginning, because it says promise, promise, promise. Yeah? Surprise, surprise, surprise. And then I like the intensity bit, where it really gets juicy. Yeah? But then I'm a tiny bit sad if it starts showing signs that it ends, and something in my attention kind of raises its head and says, okay, what's next? You know, where do we go from here? Continuity as a quality in our mindfulness is the attempt to follow the circle of something, an event in my experience, rather than just get the promising bit at the beginning and the really juicy bit at the top. We try to stay with something. Yeah? We try to fill in with our awareness the missing bits. Yeah? Now that's easier said than done, because that goes quite a bit against the grain. That seeking quality of my mind, that wishing, waiting to be somehow seduced by something that offers itself, a thought, a sight, a sound, something I can touch or taste. This seductible quality of mind is quite deep-seated. So to actually stay with a single experience, even a pleasant experience, is quite a challenge, you know. To catch it as early as possible and to stay with it till it really is over. Yeah. It's unusual. There's something radical about this. Because it means you have to face, you have to confront your habitual seeking of further promises. Seeking what else could there be had, yeah, enjoyed. So the Buddha found that in our skimming tendency, in applying attention, we end up with falsified notions of reality. For example, if you skim fast enough, things appear more solid. Yeah, it's just a simple side effect of speed. In the old days, when trains still had gaps between their wagons, you could actually see the train. And if the train was slow, you could see, you know, train, wagon, gap, next wagon, gap, wagon, and so forth. Yeah. If the train was faster, suddenly the gap seemed to narrow. You know, the things seemed to become more solid. The same holds true for our thoughts. If we are very frantic, then our thoughts seem to have sped up. You know? They have another velocity. And the velocity of thought can pretend to be more stable, can pretend to be more solid than it actually is. So one way we can help ourselves to become more aware is, for example, consistently slowing. Now, that's very well documented. You notice that you are more capable of attending to things if you consciously slow down. In breathing, in moving, in walking, it's more easy to notice what's happening if you are just if you're walking slower. To look at what helps you develop stillness of mind inevitably brings us into looking what this mind wants, because the things the mind wants and the things the mind doesn't want are the things which stop the mind from becoming still. Yeah? It's the wanting and the not wanting energy in our mind that propels our energies outward, that makes for a sort of a movement of dissipation of energy through the senses out, seeking pleasant things, avoiding unpleasant things. Yeah? And one aspect of learning to still the mind is learning to resist that impulse. It's not that you have to resist all impulses for all the time, but learning to hold an experience rather than react to that experience. With impulses, I mean, if it's nice, follow it. If it's not nice, pull away from it. Yeah. There's something in a practice of mindfulness and a practice of steadied attention that says, I'm not turning my head even if it's a pretty face, and I'm not turning my head even if it's an ugly face. Yeah. I'm not trying to latch onto it if it's nice, and I'm not trying to pull away from it or reject it if it's not nice. I'm staying aware, I'm staying my middle ground. Yeah. And that is quite radical. That deviates from the way our mind usually works. And although you seem to be simply sitting here, when you do that, sometimes you feel tired in the evening, simply because, although you haven't been doing anything else but just sitting around the whole day. But actually, steadying your attention, irrespective of your liking or your dislike, through all of it, yeah, the roses and the thorns, you learn a very precious skill. But that takes intention. It takes your willingness to do that. It takes some clarity in how you go about this. That clarity is a crucial ingredient for stillness practice. So that inevitably brings you through. You need to learn what your mind is habituated to, rather than just begrudge it for having habits and tendencies that may not make you happy or contented. You need to get to learn those tendencies. You need to be willing to get dirty hands. You need to be willing to get it wrong. You need to be willing to get in touch with what this mind wants. And help your mind to understand that some of its wants and some of its things that it doesn't want are not actually making it happy. By following those movements away from the things you don't like and towards the things you like, that this does not lead to happiness. That there is a happiness that comes from not wanting rather than getting what you want. Now, how do you not want? You can't just not want, because there's something in wanting that is quite unconvincible. Yeah. So you acknowledge what you want. You say, I want to know what you want, but I'm not going to tell you you get it. I'm not going to promise I believe it. But I want to know what I want. You want to know where it moves to. And you acknowledge this. That's powerful. That's the point where, in the midst of samatha practice, you inevitably get some insight who you are and what's happening in your heart. Yeah. For this to work, you need to be clear. And you need to be honest. What are the things that stop us from becoming still? If you do formal meditation practice, I would think most of you would probably tell me it's either physical pain or it's thought. Things that I think. So one of the big enemies of stilling the mind is thought. That's what people tell me year after year. They tell me they can't meditate because they keep thinking. And indeed, this is a big issue. We are big thinkers. Even if you're not an intellectual, you may be thinking a lot. And even if you have no illusions about the ingenuity of your thinking, you may still be thinking a lot. Thought, in terms of formal meditation practice, comes from different areas in our psyche. Now, thought is not equal thought. There are thoughts that have to do with anger, there are thoughts that have to do with desire, there are thoughts that have to do with defense, with anxiety, with doubt. Yeah. So it's necessary, if you have recurring thoughts, recurring thought patterns, yeah, which in terms of samatha practice you keep calling obstacles, and you keep, instead of investigating, you keep coming back to your breath. But if you do that for a while, and it's always the same sort of stuff that comes at you, you might as well have a closer look at this and identify What is the energy behind that thought? Of the five meditational obstacles, you know, sense desires, ill will, sleepiness and drowsiness, restlessness and disquiet of the heart, and finally doubt, of those five, 3.5 in formal meditation practice will show up as types of thought. Yeah. If you sit and you think, yeah, I have no sense desire, I would probably guess that you're fooling yourself. Yeah. Even if you don't think you're a particularly desirous sort of type, or a particularly greedy sort of type, or particularly passionate, lustful, sense pleasure-seeking type, even if you think of yourself that, I'd be very surprised, in fact, if you didn't have any sense desire coming up in the form of thoughts. I'm not just speaking of sex and food and such obvious things. But any affirmed pleasure in your mind you decide to think a little bit about, or to indulge a little bit into, or to follow, or to warm up a little bit, this is sense desire. You go through the nice conversation you had last night, that's sense desire. You go through a little bit of holiday planning, that's sense desire. You think, I go home and I'll be downloading the latest update of this. This is sense desire. You kind of go through a couple of verses of a poem you like. That is sense desire. Yeah, there's lots of sense desire going on. Any affirmed pleasure in your mind, you decide to pursue in terms of thinking about it a little bit, remembering a little bit, fantasizing a little bit, that is sense desire. Now, it is not immoral. It is quite harmless, to be truthful. You know, you have a lot worse sense desires than the ones I just mentioned. Yeah. But in terms, not of morality, but in terms of samadhi, they are detrimental. They're totally detrimental. The mind that fantasizes about things it has experienced, fantasizes things it hasn't and remembers things it has experienced, that mind is not going to become calm. Yeah. It stimulates the capacity in us to experience pleasure because it was pleasurable and I remember it, an afterglow of that experience comes up, which is agreeable to me. It is nice. And doing so is an activity which stops my mind from becoming really quiet. It stops my mind from really settling. Although it seems harmless enough, doesn't cost anything, you know, doesn't do much collateral damage, it's not abusive. At that moment, your mind is preoccupied with what it is generally preoccupied, namely, it is dissipating energy via the sense channels. It stimulates, it leaves you with, if it works, the stimulation, it leaves you with anticipation, with a degree of excitement, and it either peters out or it leaves you slightly sad because you can't continue it, or you find out it's just a thought after all. Yeah, it leaves you someplace which is not conducive to stillness. You have to understand this. Yeah? There is something very radical in that. The tendency of mind to seek happiness via the senses, which is pretty much curtailed when you sit here with eyes closed in formal meditation posture, makes it likely that instead of seeking direct sensory experience, you seek the memory or the fantasy of sensory experience to stimulate yourself. And that activity of mind has to be acknowledged. Only when you acknowledge this and acknowledge the impact it has on your wish to make the mind still, will you understand that this is quite severe. This is quite powerful stuff. So one of the things that helps you with samatha and samadhi exercises is that you're willing to renounce. You're willing to give up that thought. I'm not going to chew that old sweet memory one more time. I'm not doing that. Not because it's not nice, it is nice. Not because it wasn't happening, it was happening. Not because it's immoral, it's not immoral. But because it makes my mind not peaceful. It makes my mind in a subtle way, it influences it in the opposite direction in which I actually wish to influence it. Yeah. I see there's something quite radical about this, and it goes against the grain. It's totally against the message you get out there. If you look at any statement in our societies which says, you know, if it's good for you, go and get it. If you can't afford it, work harder until you can, you know. Freedom and choice is doing the things you want to do. And power is having the possibility to do more things you want to do. You're worth it. Go for it. This message says you get power by not wanting. This message says your mind becomes unified if you're willing to let go of things, if you're willing to renounce things. This message says there is a power that comes from giving up rather from trying to get hold of. There's something slightly scary about this, isn't it? Something slightly scary. These Buddhists. Now they come and they take all the fun out of my life. Yeah. Forever. There's some little sort of voice saying, ooh. Try it out. I mean, you know, practical knowledge will tell you that any decision you make, any yes you posit, is as much worth as the no's you're willing to place around it. Yeah. You're here because you have renounced so many other activities for today. So many other things you have missed, eternally missed. There is no guarantee that you'll ever, ever experience those things. You have thought maybe next weekend, but there is no guarantee that you even leave this place alive. You know? So in many ways, you know, every such decision is absolute, eternal. I remember my teacher used to go around at one stage, he was going around and telling everybody who said goodbye to him, he said, goodbye forever. Yeah, just to kind of hammer that one in, this counts, this may be eternal. Yeah. And this is how things work and this is how things end. We'll always pretend it continues, but actually there is no guarantee it does. So the unification of minds that comes from our power to give things up, I would like to mention. I would not want to hold back on this one. Although it's frightening, there is a strength, there is a power that comes from being able to renounce, to forsake, to give up, to let go. And your power to do the things you have decided to do very, very likely comes from your power to give up things for that. Well, most, you know, if you want to work, write a book, or climb a mountain, or grow your vegetables organically, you need to work. You need to give things up for that. If you say, I love you, or I marry you, and then I say, I love you, and I love you, and I love you, this does something, isn't it? There is an acknowledgement that the things we can do, our time and our attention, are finite commodities. They're not infinite. Mm-hmm. And if I want to take something serious and give my heart to this, I need to be prepared to give things up for that. There's no way that you can say a convincing yes without saying many, many no's to protect that yes. I don't know another way. It's coming down even to meditation techniques. You know, obviously you could sit here and do a little bit of asubha practice and then a little bit of metta, and then you could go through the 40... ten anusatis the Buddha Gosa was speaking about, and then do some kasina exercise and go back to the breath for 3 minutes. You know, you could do all this, and it's all good stuff. But unless you're willing to actually deepen one, none of them will yield results. And if you have, by chance, any good results, you wouldn't know what it is due to, because you have played around so much with your methodology. I guess do not underestimate the small acts of decision you make, you know, clarifying what you want to do, clarifying what you do when you find out that you're not doing this, and sticking to things. Be clear and intend these things, affirm these things. What is my practice? Now, if you practice for many years, then I don't do the same things all the time, and I don't do the same things I started off practicing with 30 years ago, just to be clear. You know, there are many effective ways of meditating, depending on your temperament, depending on how much experience you have, depending on particular needs of the situation you're in, depending on the way you wish to develop aspects of mind. There are many different ways, and you may at one or the other stage shift your emphasis in the way you meditate, but such shifts should be negotiated. Such shifts are best under supervision. Yeah. If you feel compelled to make such shifts 15 times in half an hour meditation practice, I would suggest that you come and talk to me about this. Or you stick to one of your two approaches. Half of your time stillness practice, in which everything is a meditational obstacle outside of what you have decided is your meditation exercise. And then for the rest of half of the time, you turn whatever clarity, whatever stillness you have, towards that which stops you from becoming more still. In other words, the things you have declared meditational obstacles in the first half hour, you are now willing to look at, to be with, and to more closely investigate. But if you don't do that first half an hour, such an investigation is a lot less effective than if you have done that half hour or half time. I think that's my message for today. Don't miss out on that half hour. However intelligent and gifted you may be, it's very difficult to meet the mind without having some experience of stilling, some experience of foundation, some experience of the strength that comes from and the power of the depth that is in that mind. A depth that can only be found if you're willing to dive beneath the moving and eternally restless surface. Can I stop here and see whether there are questions to this? Yes, please.
When you talk about renouncing, say, take a memory or an image, you know, to paraphrase you, you're saying, don't go there. Don't indulge in that memory or that image.
I would say it more kindly.
Would. All right, then. Would you paraphrase what we said? In English, we often say, "Don't. I'm not going there." It means I'm not going down that road.
Well, you smile at it, and you say, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And it's thanks, but no thanks. Something comes up, and obviously wishes to be acknowledged, wishes to be held, and invites you to follow it. Yeah, that's what thoughts do. They wish to be joined. They wish to be followed. And you just nod, say thank you, and go your way. Yeah. You don't need to combat it, but you need to be clear that you're not having this right now. Okay. That you're not going with it. Yeah, but you keep going the path you have decided initially, rather than take a turn and say, "Oh, nice to meet you. Let's go." And yeah. It's important to not mistake that with hostility, or not mistake that with a moral judgment. It is a simple truth in the economy of mind and attention that the seeking of pleasure by remembering or by fantasizing takes you away from your chances to become still. That seems to be the price going into stillness takes.
It's like saying, you know, would you like to dance? And you say, no thanks.
Right, I'm waiting for the beau who's coming in there. You know? But he hasn't quite arrived yet, so you need to... Okay. Obviously you could kiss rows of frogs and find out whether you... But after you've kissed a few frogs, somehow you might notice that it doesn't. Most of the frogs don't seem to transform. My frogs don't. And there is something radical, because the suggestion of the mind to go into, say, seeking, pleasure seeking, are so harmless, you know. And our societies are so affirmative of this. It's underestimated how much sway that has, and sometimes it's not, you know, it's not the great ecstatic passion you're seeking. You're seeking the comfort. You're seeking the little bit of pampering. You're seeking the little safeties. You know, it's not big, but you can say yes, I want to meditate. Yes, I go on retreat. You know, that's the big yes, and then you can say 500 little no's. You know. Just in terms of not following through with that yes, but actually doing 1,000 things that take you away from that radicalness. Good. Please.
Within a meditation sitting, I'm sure we all have experience of success in doing that to a greater or lesser extent at different times. But as we go about our business during the day, Maybe you could talk about that a bit, in, just in terms of A, it's bloody exhausting just to try and like constantly be coming back to where you are now and not go off in some direction and not follow something, just to keep that kind of awareness throughout the day is really tiring. And you know, there's always a tendency to be like, oh well, I've been mindful, I'm aware this is what's happening, but just for a bit, not necessarily even because it's pleasurable, but just for me sometimes because it's to keep that awareness, it's tiring, and then I think there's a hardening around it. So what can we do about that?
Well, you could let it. You could say, fine, this is your time. Go for it. Have your fun. You could try to give it a space, a time, an acknowledged, negotiated slot. You see, samadhi practice, as I just described, is an intentional practice, and it tries to intentionally streamline some of what you do with your attention that goes against the grain. It's a lot easier to do that if you have supportive conditions. So one of the things that people experience is they try to do that, and if they get a taste of stillness of mind, they really love that, because stillness of mind tastes really good. It tastes better than your memories, a lot better. It can be a lot more ecstatic than any memory you can bring up to. And once people start actually having some success, they wish to go back there, and then it's very easy to turn relationship and commitments and everything that isn't samadhi practice into a meditational obstacle. So your world splits into two parts. One is your meditation practice, and the rest is basically an obstacle. And that's not very nice for your kids and your relationships and your job, and it doesn't really make very happy. So that's why samadhi practice isn't really a terribly easily integratable sort of exercise on its own. And I guess that's one of the reasons why mindfulness practice is a lot less offensive in terms of of society and conditioning, you know, because it is something that doesn't challenge you on that score. It seems we can integrate it much more in my life. At the same time, there's also an illusion, you know. Anything that hasn't made you enlightened until today is probably not worth pursuing today. You know, if you're interested in awakening and your habits and your tendencies haven't made you enlightened, you may as well try out something else. You may as well try out some of the conditioning. And to do that, you will need to put in effort, you know. There's no way that you can learn something without actually putting in the effort. The question is, where is it skillful to actually try to practice, say, samatha? Now, if you're working, if I travel, and I do more traveling than I like and than I would wish I do, I don't try to practice samatha because that makes me crabby, you know. Mm-hmm. You can turn whole airports into meditational obstacles. And they would win. They're just, you know, they're bigger. So you try to not to control, but you try to go into a more spacious mode, because that helps you not to get stuck or not to be impinged too hard. The more resistance you offer, the more you get impinged on. It's like I change the screen resolution, you know. It's kind of, I let it become grainy. And I don't latch onto things with my attention so much. But if I have opportunity like sitting here with you, and it's peaceful and it's quiet, and it feels safe, and I am in a supportive atmosphere, I allow the mind to become more fine, more and more fine, because I don't need to react to people who want my money or to trains that come late or to people that bump into me. I can actually afford refining an aspect of mind. So you need to find places and times in your life where this is doable, rather than adopt a meditation practice which basically antagonizes the rest of your life or turns the rest of your life into a meditational obstacle. I think you need to calibrate under what circumstances you can practice, say, samatha exercises. I wouldn't use that as a sort of daily mindfulness in activities practice at all. While the daily mindfulness in activities practice will help your samatha, trying to be highly focused on one aspect of mind or of your experience, like you inevitably do in samatha, is highly ineffective for going through your everyday life. You know, it's unlike mindfulness. It's not so applicable directly. It's applicable indirectly in that it allows a stillness of mind, which then enables you to see more clearly, understand more profoundly. While sati is directly applicable in your life, samadhi is indirectly applicable in your life. It makes you more calm, for example. That means you are less prone to anxiety, you're less prone to irritation. It makes you more perceptually more clear. It makes you more grounded. You have a clearer understanding of what you need and what you want and where you go and what's important, what is not, what is wholesome, what is not. All this stuff is helped by your capacity to stillness. But trying to be practicing samatha exercises when you drive through town, I would think is very difficult. And I don't think it's very good. In fact, because you keep trying to make the focus more narrow than driving a car safely through town, necessitates. You don't want to have people narrowly focused sitting behind wheels. You want them to be wide and scanning and aware. So you need to create the safety for samatha practice. Do I answer to your question?
I think so. I think just for my own clarification, just say the idea is to have this awareness which is continuous, but to have a fluidity within that which sort of expands and contracts as the conditions around you dictate and necessitate.
I would call that a mindfulness practice. This is very applicable. This is very useful. Any time of the day, actually.
Still quite exhausting.
Well, there's no guarantee that good things are not exhausting, you know. I don't have kids, but I've been told that having babies is perfectly natural, but it seems to be quite an effort to, there's no guarantee that things that are natural are easy or come without effort. This is kind of a sort of many things that we are capable of, and I believe in natural, our hard work.
Demanding.
Yeah, I'm just continuing from that. I was going to ask the question about stillness in everyday life, and stillness as we would ordinarily use it. It sounds like what you're saying here is that's mindfulness if applied as opposed to samatha practice, which is very hard to do anywhere but in on the cushion. Whereas if you're applying it in everyday life and feel still, that would be more of a mindfulness practice?
I would say so, yeah. You see, they're not as hard and fast to keep apart. Yeah, the raw material for both stillness in terms of samatha and insight understanding is definitely sati. In sati, you have as seed qualities the stability factor. You have a seed quality, the capacity to stick with something and stay with something, which is the beginning of insight practice. Now sati in itself has these qualities as facets. Yeah. If you practice samatha, you emphasize the stillness, stability, absorbing, entering into aspect more strongly. If you're into more vipassana type practices, you trained the mobility, staying with spatial, acknowledging things coming, going type facet of sati. But the beauty of this, and that's where these forms of meditation come from, is basically already there within sati. The capacity to both stabilizing in the midst of changing conditions as one aspect, and the capacity to follow one of these changing dynamics in the midst of other dynamics that are happening concurrently. This is already there. And if you wanted to be sloppy, you could say, we're basically practicing sati and deepen it with a slight shift in emphasis. In inside practice, the sati has to investigate, it has to work harder. In samatha practice, the sati has to be initially more clear and more decisive where it doesn't go. The path begins more narrow. And then afterwards it gets a lot more pleasant, you know, when the stillness actually starts. Because the mind likes to be still and it likes to go there. You don't need to push it. How could I say? Well, it's a beautiful example of a cowherd in the suttas. And two situations. The first situation is before the harvest is before the field is harvested. So the cows keep wanting to go into the field with ripe fruit. And our cowherd has a hard time to keep them out of the ripe fruit. Instead of standing on the meadow, they keep wanting to go into the field and eat the fruit. And our cowherd has to scream at them, he has to shake his arms, he has a stick, and he has to prod them and keep them out of the field. And this type of practice is what the Buddha calls protection. And then you have the same scene a couple of months later, the field is harvested, the cows don't run away anymore because there isn't a place they really feel like running towards. So they're quite happy standing there on the meadow. And our cowherd doesn't have to jump around and shake his arms and scream and prod. He just lies in the shadow or sits in the shadow of a tree or a bush. And he knows, and here the word sati is used, he knows the cows are there. But this is a... Now, if the situation you're in and your mind is behaving like a wild cow wanting to run somewhere where she shouldn't run, you have to, irrespective of your definition of sati, you have to do the necessary things that this doesn't happen. Yeah? But you don't make a habit of that type of energy application. You find out whether the cows really are that wild, and if they're not wild, you stop making such a fuss, you relax. So this is the same with our mind. There will be days when your mind is going to be racing. It's going to be white water ride. You just try to stay on top of it, not lose your mat, basically. And there will be days your mind will be quite docile and placid and alert and go to places you have never thought possible. And having gone to the latter, there is no guarantee that it doesn't go back to wild tiger mode the next day. Good? Let us do some... Are these questions? Is this a question?
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
You know, at the end of this weekend, I realize I understand even less than when I first arrived. seriously.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. But at one stage, I got a feeling of... a feeling of anxiety, feeling like there is something which I need to have, which I haven't got. And it goes back to the whole thing of being a child. Every good boy deserves favors. But you've made it quite clear that there are things to let go. It's the letting go that's essential. Because they're going to be taken away from me anyway. to have the choice of being push or jump. These two things. I realize listening to you that this feeling of there is something, there is a carrot somewhere, which I have an added bite at. At the same time, on the other side, there is this urgency to let go. I don't know if this is a question, but I'm just sharing something which I felt.
It sounds like there's something in you that knows there is a possibility. And that possibility means leaving behind some of the things you know and you have come accustomed to. And I guess if that possibility becomes strong enough, if your confidence that possibility is there is strong enough, then you are prepared to leave things behind to verify. Yeah. If you are not confident, or if you are too afraid, then you're probably not going to leave things behind. You're not going to leave the safe shore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were probably not likely to find out, because to find out you would have to go a bit further. Yeah. If it works ideally, then you have just enough confidence to take out, to make a few steps in a direction you're not sure. And you will be able to confirm for yourself that it is possible to go there, even though you didn't think it was, but it is possible. And in fact, good things may happen to you there. And maybe that gives you enough confidence to take the next few steps. That's generally how it works. We don't quite know where it goes, but we feel in us the energy, the trust, the faith. You know, in Buddhist psychology, this is the role of faith. You're not sure. You have a sort of an inkling that something is waiting there. And you try it. Mm-hmm. And while trying it, suddenly something becomes possible that would not be possible unless you have actually tried. Mm-hmm. And to try it, you need to lean out a bit. You need to do something beyond what you know. You need to go where you haven't been. Mm-hmm. I'm glad for you. I'm glad. I believe there are things possible we don't think are reasonable. You know, reason won't get you out of it. If I was reasonable, I would never have learned to walk. So I'm conscious if I stay with what I know, I will stop growing, because everything else is unreasonable. I wish you trust your intelligence and your sensitivity and take steps in that direction.